My brothers and sisters, if one of you should wander from the truth and someone should bring that person back, remember this. Whoever turns a sinner from the error of their ways will save them from death and cover over a multitude of sins. The word of the Lord.
Well, this morning finishes up our study of the book of James. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. I think I see James a little differently now than I first did. I used to kind of feel like it was a random, kind of choppy book, broken up a lot. And I tried to see what that logical thread was that goes through this. And I see now, I think, that the logical thread that goes through James is he is very serious about following Jesus. Everything James says, he's very serious about. And I think in these last two verses, even though they're small, it's just very compact two verses, we see that James is serious about something for us as well, that we have a serious responsibility as well. They remind me of a young man who was interviewing for a job as an usher at a movie theater. And while he was during the interview, the manager asked him, "So tell me, what would you do if a fire broke out in the theater?" And the young guy said, "Oh, don't worry about me. I'd get out all right." There's a lot at stake here in this life. And if you're just thinking about yourself in the Christian life, you're not really doing your job. The idea of wandering here may not be as innocent as it first appears. The Old Testament use of this idea of wandering tends to describe people who have gone off the right path because of idolatry or because they have divided loyalties toward God. A person who wanders in this sense isn't someone who accidentally or unconsciously is departing from the truth. It's not innocent. And so what is the truth that James is warning against wandering away from? In the Bible, truth isn't just a theoretical belief. Truth is life-changing. When the truth takes hold of your mind, your life changes. It's supposed to do something to you. The Bible portrays truth as a path to be followed, the way of the Lord, the way of truth. Truth is a major theme in the Gospel of John. John 1, the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. John 3, Jesus says, "Whoever lives by the truth comes into the light, so that it may be seen plainly that what he has been done through God." To the Jews who had believed in him, Jesus said, "If you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free." Jesus, as he was praying, and tells his followers what he's going to pray for, and he says, "I will ask the Father, and he will give you another counselor to be with you forever, the Spirit of truth." And then, right at the end of John's gospel, you remember that scene with Pilate. And Pilate is questioning Jesus, and he says, "So you're a king then?" And Jesus answered, "You're right in saying that I'm a king. In fact, for this very reason I was born. And for this I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me." And Pilate asked him, "What is truth?" Jesus makes no reply to Pilate's question, because standing there in front of Pilate is the truth. The truth is embodied in Jesus. The freedom Jesus promised that the truth would give is the freedom from slavery to sin. Truth guides us from death to life. James wants us to have the life that grows out of the truth as it is in Jesus, the truth that we can't have and the life that we can't have any other way. One other passage from John about truth is found in John chapter 14. Jesus said, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." Eugene Peterson has a really interesting observation, I think, about that statement from Jesus, "I am the way and the truth and the life." He says, way comes first. Way comes first. And he said that Jesus as the truth gets a whole lot more attention than Jesus as the way. He says that Jesus as the way is the most frequently avoided metaphor among Christians. When we hear here at the end of James, someone is wandering from the truth, we usually think of some doctrinal error, having the wrong ideas or opinions about God or the church or how we worship or about Scripture. And those things are important. They do impact our life and our. But you've probably discovered, as I have, that there are good, loving Christians who sometimes see things very differently. There are people who are full of the Spirit who have very different views on how the Spirit works. Recently, I was with some young Christians who were discussing how to answer a Muslim friend of theirs who had asked why there was so much disagreement among Christians. Why are there so many different versions of the church? I think that's a good question. But one thing I was thinking about, you know, while they were talking about that question was how Christianity has been so influenced by Western culture. We value intellect over belief. Over behavior. We value belief over behavior. Belief over practice. But these two things, belief and practice, intellect and behavior, are meant to be kept together. Truth isn't something just to be believed. It's something to be practiced. This emphasis has been throughout James' letter. In chapter 3, he says, "Who is wise and understanding among you? Then let them show it by their good life, by deeds done in the humility that comes from wisdom. But if you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, don't boast about it. You're denying the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from heaven. It's earthly. It's unspiritual. It's demonic. For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you'll find disorder and every evil practice." And then James says, "But the wisdom that comes from heaven is first of all pure, then it's peace-loving, it's considerate, it's submissive, it's full of mercy and good fruit, it's impartial and sincere." James' opponents in the church were teaching that faith was somehow separate from ethics. You could separate what you believe from the way you live, from your behavior. They were promoting the values of Roman society, presenting the Christian church just as another way to climb the social ladder. In James' view, truth is the practice of God's wise way of living life. Eugene Peterson says again, "We can't skip the way of Jesus in our hurry to get to the truth of Jesus as He is worshiped and proclaimed. The way of Jesus is the way that we practice and come to understand the truth of Jesus. Living Jesus in our homes and workplaces, with our friends and family, the Jesus way wedded to the Jesus truth brings about the Jesus life." Now, we just review a little bit and think about the things that James has talked about in his letter. Misuse of the tongue in many different ways. Jealousy. Lack of concern for the poor. Worldliness. Quarreling with each other. You think about those things and then you realize that what James has been doing all along in this epistle is to prevent Christians from wandering away from what he understands is the truth. Jesus' wise way of living. Wandering from God's way of living, that is what sin is. Not having a different opinion from someone else. James wants to coax those who are wandering dangerously close to the cliff edge of spiritual death there. Come back. Come back to the life that you've known in Jesus. In our society, it seems like we only want to hear the truth from two people, the doctor and the mechanic. Those are the only places that we think we can afford not to hear the truth from. We don't want to hear the truth from our spouse or from our children or our coworkers, and sometimes our Christian brothers and sisters. But oh, how we need to hear the truth. It's not enough to just be concerned about your own life and your own spiritual safety. Sin isn't just a personal problem, it's a community problem. It affects everybody, and we have a responsibility for each other. The community of faith that James envisions, and he gets this from Jesus, is dependent to such an extent on each other. We are so bound together that life and death hang in the balance. It's a startling realization. Back about a dozen years ago, in one summer day in Kew Creek, Pennsylvania, you may remember, there were 9 miners down in a coal mine, and they were digging on the face of the mine there, digging coal out with their machinery. And they were unaware that on the other side of that wall that they were digging on was an abandoned mine. It had been abandoned 50 or 60 years, and it was filled with water. It was completely flooded. As soon as their machinery breached the wall, 60 million gallons of water came flowing into their mine, which was lower than the one that was next to them that was flooded. 60 million gallons of water. They were trapped immediately underground. The crew chief wanted all 9 of his men together, so he just had a few seconds. And the guy who had been operating the piece of equipment that had actually gone through the wall jumped off the wrong side of the equipment. And so there was this torrent of water between him and the rest of the crew. But the crew chief jumped on another piece of machinery and just inched it out some way into the water, just enough where the guy on the other side could jump across to safety. And now all 9 were together. They retreated to the highest place they could find in the tunnel that they were in, and they found themselves trapped in a 4-foot-high by 10-foot-wide chamber with the water rising all around them. At the rate the water was rising, they estimated they had 1 hour to live. One of the men had a pen, and somebody found a scrap of cardboard. And each one took a few minutes and wrote a note out to their family. They found a bucket. They put it inside the bucket, sealed it up, and taped it. And they felt like, at least our families will find this message from us. Thankfully, though, rescuers on the surface had realized very quickly what was happening, and they started rushing pumps from all over the county and then the state to try to pump the water out, and they were able to arrest the flow of the water before the men were submerged. At one point, they were up to their necks in the water. They only had that much time to live. But they were still trapped 240 feet underground. They were wet, they were hungry, and they were scared to death. And it was so cold that their greatest danger was dying of hypothermia. When one of them got cold, the other 8 would huddle around and warm that person. And when another person got cold, they switched off. The favor was returned. They decided they would live or die together as a family. So they took a rope and they tied it around each one of their waists so that they were bound together. One of the men said, "Everybody had strong moments, but any time one guy got down, the rest pulled together." And then that guy would get back up, and maybe somebody else would feel weak, and he would reach out and help him. After 77 hours, they rescued these men. The news called it the Miracle at Kew Creek. All 9 were safely rescued. They thanked profusely all the people who had worked on the surface to rescue them. But they also realized how they had needed each other in that moment. In those desperate hours, one of the men said afterwards that it was a team effort and that that was the only way that it could have been. He said, "It took all 9 of us. It took all 9. One day, we are going to see clearly how much we need each other, how much we've needed each other, we're going to realize it takes each one. How would it change you right now if you opened yourself to the idea that God is working in these other people in this room and others in your life, Christians, followers of Christ, to bring you to be conformed to the life of Christ? What if that was the only way for you to find the freedom and the joy that you're seeking in life is somehow with these other people? What if that's the way God designed this life in the first place, that it had to be lived together? Wouldn't that be like being rescued from death? Wouldn't it cover a multitude of sins? So I ask you today, let's find a way to renew our courage. It takes courage to be open to each other, to be open to, you know, really listening to the way other people perceive you and perceive the way that you are living your life. We really like to put up defenses out there. It's very difficult to hear the truth about yourself as it's reflected back to you through another person. But that's our job, both to receive it and to give that kind of reflection to each other of the truth, how we're measuring up to the life of Christ.